Hello, everyone, and welcome. We are going to get started here in a couple of minutes as people are joining. So just hang on. We are going to be using the Q&A feature, and we're going to get some messages in the text about that in a minute. Hi again. We see everybody still joining, so we are going to start in a couple of minutes. Once we give everybody a chance to join the webinar, we already see our first Q&A. So good job using that feature. The webinar will be recorded and it's going to be posted on the program page. So we will repeat this information again throughout the webinar. But yes, you'll have access to the recording of this and also to the slides. Let's hold on for just one more minute as people are joining the webinar. We will start at 3:05. All right. It is 3:05, so if my colleagues are ready, we can get started. Welcome, everyone. We are happy to see you all here, all almost 700 of you and increasing. This is the Smart Health and Biomedical Research in the Era of Artificial Intelligence and Advanced Data Science Solicitation Informational Webinar. The solicitation number is NSF23-614. My name is Goli Yamini, and I'm here today with Tom Martin, from my NSF, and Dana Wolf-Hughes and Yanli Wang from NIH. Would everybody like to introduce themselves?
Hello, everybody. I'm Tom Martin. I'm with Goli and SAIS at the NSF in Information Intelligence Systems.
Dana?
Hi, everybody. I'm Dana Wolf-Hughes. I'm a program officer at the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health. I've had the pleasure of co-leading this initiative with Goli and Tom and formerly Wendy Nelson for the past 6 or 7 years now.
Thanks. Yanli?
Yeah, my name is Yanli Wang. I'm a program officer at the National Library of Medicine of NIH. Thank you.
Thank you. We have some of our other colleagues here with us as well from the NSF group. I think Jim is here. If you would like to introduce yourself, and then I'll kind of go down the list of all of our other colleagues.
Sure. I'm Jim Fowler. I am an IPA rotator from Mississippi State University. I'm at the National Science Foundation in the Communications and Computer Foundations Division.
Thank you. As you can see, some of our colleagues at NSF are from, within this working group are from all the participating directorates and divisions. We have Stephen Breckler from SBE, who's been with us for a long time, Yulia Gell, James Fowler, who just introduced himself, Georgia Ann Klutke, Tatiana Koraleski, Vishal Sharma from CNS, Sylvia Spengler, who's been with us in IAS for a while, Betty Tuller from SBE, and Christopher Yang, who's also from IIS. I'm going to hand things off to Dana to introduce the NIH folks.
Thanks, Goli. So we have quite the number of individuals from NIH that are represented. Currently, we have 29 institute centers and offices at NIH that have signed on to this initiative. So we've covered really the gamut of interest from health conditions, different areas within the biomedical, public health, and behavioral sciences realm. I'm not going to name everyone on here, but just to say, it takes a village between the NSF and the NIH team. We have over 100 people, program federal employees, touching this initiative. So it's quite a large initiative, hopefully one in which you all are taking a process in as applicants or reviewers.
Thanks, Dana. So first off, let's start with what the goals of the program are and what essentially inspired for NSF and NIH to come together for the Smart Health program. It's essentially that we see a lot of computing, engineering, and math and social behavioral sciences advancements that are transforming the world that are not reflected necessarily in advancing health. And so the goal of this initiative in part is to try and bring some of the transformative initiatives and advancements that we've seen in other areas to health. The applications, successful applications must address research gaps in science and engineering. And we're going to spend a little bit of time about what that means, while addressing a key health and biomedical problem. So essentially, it's use-inspired research. The team must include appropriate research expertise in the areas that the work are. And, you know, we get a question often about whether you need a clinician on the team. You don't necessarily need a clinician on the team, but you definitely need the appropriate expertise in order to have a good enough team to be able to address the research problems that are of interest to this program. This is a cross-cutting program between NSF and NIH. The due date is November 9th in 2023, 5 p.m. your local time. The projects are integrative, and we will talk a little bit more about that. But the total cost, the award amounts, the total cost is $1.2 million, and that's for direct and indirect, which is $300,000 a year for up to 4 years. The teams have to be interdisciplinary, and the contribution to foundational science has to be in at least two NSF fields. We're going to go over this a little bit more. As I just mentioned, SCH is a case of use-inspired basic research. I just want to ask Dana, do you want to comment at all about the budget?
Yeah, thanks, Goli. So I think what's important here for individuals who are typically applying to NIH for applications is that, the as Goli mentioned, the total cost is $1.2 million for up to 4 years. And that includes both the direct and indirect costs, so a little bit different than what we typically see at the NIH. And I think that's really important, not only because of the different structure, but that if you're selected for funding at NIH, you're going to have to transform your budget back into the NIH form. So keep that in mind as you're putting together your applications. Back to you, Goli.
Thank you. I'm actually going to hand things off to Tom.
Thanks, Goli. So like Goli said, Smart Health is a case of use-inspired basic research. And the slide you're seeing here is based on Donald Stokes's book, Pasture Squadron from the 90s, where he put the quest for basic understanding on one axis, basic research, and the considerations of use, applied research, on another axis. And so while the NSF supports basic research like fundamental physics, which is the Niels Bohr quadrant on here, what Smart Health is looking for is analogous to Louis Pasteur, who did fundamental microbiology research, but it was aimed at having an impact on his community. There's also the applied quadrant, represented here by Steve Jobs, who takes fundamental science and creates applications out of that science. And while that's important, it's not what we're looking for in Smart Health. What we're looking for is fundamental advances in science and engineering, as Goli said, that address health and biomedical issues, advances that are transformative, high risk, and high reward, like Pasteur. And so, we want those advances to be in computer and information science, engineering, math, statistics, behavioral cognitive science, while addressing pressing questions in the biomedical and public health communities. And we want advances that cover a research gap, not just taking existing techniques and applying them to a health issue. So you should ask yourself, what are the gaps in fundamental science and engineering that have to be addressed before you can make an advance on a key health issue? And this combination of making an advance in the fundamental science and engineering while addressing a key health issue is going to require appropriate research expertise covering all the major aspects of your project. So a really common question, I think what I've even seen it in the chat already, is whether you need to have a clinician on your team. And no, you don't have to have a clinician, but you do need the appropriate research expertise, somebody who knows the relevant research literature. And that could be somebody from biology or public health, for example, or a clinical researcher. Next slide, Goli, please. So if you read the current solicitation, there are seven themes there, and we're going to discuss those over the next few slides. These themes are detailed in the solicitation, but your proposals are not limited to just these themes. Whether your idea fits into one of these themes or not, we recommend talking with the NSF program director about it. Next slide, Goli, there you go.
So these themes, as Tom noted, are not mutually exclusive and they're not fully expansive. We encourage you to come and present things and apply your perspective. So this is not all encompassing. But one of the themes is fairness and trustworthiness. And really the focus here is real world considerations beyond conventional analytical approaches. And we're really focusing here on new directions for computational science that are fair and trustworthy for clinicians, for patients, for participants. And what underpinning that includes things like algorithmic bias, data fairness, new models for causality that can be developed, and new methods that can help address disparities, improve equity as well, including integration and linkages to social and economic data, the ability to use and create novel methods that account for a broad range of uncertainties in the data, and the potential to have new insights into human AI systems for clinical decision support. Next slide. Another one of our themes is transformative analytics. And this includes different bucket areas such as fusion and analysis of multi-level and multi-scale data, especially in scenarios where there are either limited data, noisy data, or missingness. New tools and techniques for visualization and modeling of the data, and behavioral, contextual, and multimodal data. Next slide.
So another theme is multimodal and reconfigurable sensors. And what we mean by that is we're not looking for sensors that are just a single type, but integrated systems that sense different types of signals, not just electrochemical, but for instance, biochemical, magnetic, acoustic, and so on. And again, in an integrated system. Next slide, please, Goli. We're also interested in cyber-physical systems aimed at biomedical areas. So these are closed loop or human in the loop systems that combine computation, communication, and control. Cyber-physical systems research can cover a wide variety of fundamental topics, such as dependability, trustworthiness, high assurance, formal verification, and even unconventional substrates, for example, integrated electronic and biological substrates. Next slide, Goli, please. Robotics is another theme, and robotics covers intelligence that's embodied in such a way that it processes information, senses, plans, and either moves or substantially alters its moves within or substantially alters its working environment. So we're looking for novel robotics that address a key health issue, such as enhancing health, improving social connection, reducing disability, you know, and not just limited to things that are common right now, like surgical robotics. Research issues in human-robot interaction are also important. Next slide, Goli.
The other thing we're looking at is biomedical imaging interpretation. We want to look at image presentation, basically how human pattern recognition, visual searches, perceptual learning, attentional bias, and et cetera, can really affect how observers are understanding images. We really want to understand context and environment. So when you're analyzing images, when you're looking at an image, what kind of things effective both in context and environment are we seeing, including human environments? But we also want you to exploit these understandings. Like, can we do a better job at providing images in a way that they help perceptual decision-making? And could this be, and you know, this could be in both 3D and 4D. The last theme that we're talking about, which is definitely not mutually exclusive from any of the other themes that we discussed, is unpacking health disparities and health equity. For this theme, we really are focusing on reduction, assessment, and mitigation. Where you live determines your life expectancy and relates to social determinants of health. For example, this is a map, a map of New Orleans with life expectancy noted in different geographical areas. For example, in this area where it's an affluent suburb of New Orleans, life expectancy is higher in some of the lower income areas. And, you know, the reduction assessment and mitigation can be done with either data-driven AI models or developing new strategies or understandings of how discrimination or bias affect social determinants of health and or develop novel methods of distinguishing basically complex pathways between levels of influence and domain in this area. We are now going to talk about the review process. This is an NSF-NIH joint program, and our review process is also a joint review process. And I'm going to get help from my colleagues, Tom and Dana, in kind of walking us through this pathway. What I want to start with saying is that the proposals come into NSF, which is why we're going to emphasize later again that please make sure they're written in the NSF format. They're going to come into NSF, get paneled here, and get reviewed jointly by NSF PDs and NIH science review officers. So within the review process, once the panel and the reviewers go over the proposal, the NSF PDs are going to ask them to rank the proposal, and then the NIH SROs are going to ask for the scoring. And I want to hand this to Dana to kind of explain that a little bit more, and then to Tom to kind of follow through with this part.
Thanks, Goli. So as Goli said, these applications are submitted directly to NSF. For this round, it'll be November 9th, 5 p.m. local. You'll submit them to NSF in the NSF form. NIH and NSF work together to put together these joint review panels, in which there's going to be an NSF PD in the panel and an NIH scientific review officer. It will get both scores. And then once the scores for the NIH side occur after these panels are done, we have these applications not only scored in the NIH form, they also are percentiled. And the reviews that occur during this time are written in the NSF format. So everything up until this point is still NSF except the NIH scores and percentiles. It's at that time that the NIH staff meet to discuss which applications are of interest to the institutes and centers for selection to come over to NIH. If that were to occur, what will happen is you will receive an email from myself, Goli, Tom, and others notifying you of this and providing you instructions of how to move forward with resubmitting your application to NIH. You'll go through that process, submitting it. It does not get re-reviewed at that point. It just goes through the system, through what we call a dummy panel. Those scores that occurred during the initial joint review process are released. And then everything that you would do normally from there for funding, going to council and whatnot, stays the same. So it's a little bit of a different process, but just know that I think really important to this is that your application will only be reviewed once, but it will receive an NSF and an NIH score. Tom?
Dana, you and Goli have done such a good job with that. I don't think I have anything to add to it. So I would just reiterate for everyone, you will submit an NSF proposal. It will go through a normal NSF review panel with an NIH SRO present, and it'll get a score in addition to the normal NSF review and rating. So next slide, please.
I just wanted to say one more thing. Because of this joint review process and sort of the timelines that NIH and NSF meet, sometimes our funding timeline gets extended, and there is a difference between when NSF considers a start of project and when NIH considers start of project. So Dana, if you want to elaborate on that, but the NIH for them, when you apply here, the start date would be the fall. So that's sort of when to expect news and funding.
Yeah, or a little bit later, depending. So we'll go through this round, for example. You all will submit in November, reviews will occur sometime in the winter, and those you'll have a score. Then we go through the process of selection in early spring. And if you're selected for funding at NIH, for example, you'll go to summer council like June, July, maybe even August, or May through August, you'll go through council depending on the institute or center in which you're going to be funded. Depending on where you're selected for funding at NIH, you could either receive funds by the end of the fiscal year of FY24, or for example, if you were going to be funded by NCI, for example, we would not make the award until December. So it is not uncommon to have a delay. It does not mean that you're not going to be funded when you are selected to move forward at NIH. It is not an official notice of award or selection of funding, but it is fairly likely that that award will be made. But we just want to note for you all that there is that delay that can occur. And just to be in constant contact with your program officer at the institute or center that's going to be making that award for updates. Goalie.
Thank you.
So the standard NSF review criteria of both intellectual merit and broader impact apply. And this page lists the elements that will be considered for both criteria, and you should consider them in the top-down order. As we've said before, smart health proposals have to make fundamental contributions in science and engineering. So that advancing knowledge and understanding within its own field or across different fields for the intellectual merit is very, very important, and I can't emphasize that enough, okay? You can't take just an existing technique and apply it to a health problem. You have to make fundamental contributions to science and engineering. Next slide, please, Julie. The other thing is the broader impacts include the benefits to society and advancing desired societal outcomes. This isn't an exhaustive list, but it's important to keep in mind the red bullet at the bottom. The broader impact can't just be the biomedical or health impact. It's got to be more than that. So next slide, please, Goli. So what are the advances in terms of the scientific requirement? What are the advances in the foundational science and engineering? How novel and transformative are they? Is there a good plan for making these advances? Does the proposal include the right team? So looking at the collaboration management plan, do they have good institutional support? And we'll talk about each of these three things in the next few slides. Next slide, please, Goli.
So we are going to discuss advancements in two fundamental science and engineering areas. We referred to this a few times before, that the proposals have to include at least two areas. Now, the areas that we're looking at in computer information sciences are artificial intelligence, machine learning, informatics, computer architecture, so on and so forth. And engineering is multimodal sensors and all the way to dynamic systems and materials. For math and statistics, it's like stochastic modeling, analysis, interpretation, and characterizing uncertainty. And in areas of social behavior and cognitive sciences, we're looking at perception, social psychology, cognition, emotion, economics, ethics, and linguistics. But what I wanted to highlight here is that when we talk about two areas, we don't necessarily mean that you have to have computer science and engineering, or computer science and social behavioral sciences, or engineering and math, or any of these two. It could also be two areas within the same discipline. So it can be two different areas of computer science, like artificial intelligence and natural language technology, or it can be something like sensors and AI, or social psychology and like sensing, or mathematical stochastic modeling, or something like that. So it can be either two different areas of science and engineering, NSF science and engineering. Again, when we're talking about science, we mean NSF science. So these disciplines, or within the same discipline, that two areas of focus, those could be the two that apply. And we want to kind of hammer this in today. This is probably one of the most important take-home messages for us, that the primary advancement has to be in these areas of science. Like health for us is a essentially area of impact. It's a use space. It's a use case. It's not necessarily the area of advancement that we are looking at.
Can I jump in there, Goli?
Yes.
When you are putting together your teams, you, as the applicant, need to be able to articulate how you're advancing the two fundamental areas and how the team you're putting together mirrors on that. And Goli has mentioned before, we get a lot of questions of, do I need to have a clinician on this? That is up to you. It needs to make sense, and you need to be able to articulate that in your application. Throwing a clinician on your application because you think that you need to because NIH is involved is not going to do you well in review. It's actually most likely going to hurt you because it doesn't make sense to the review team looking at your application. Also, as Goli said, you need to be focused on fundamental science and engineering and the transformations and advances that are going to occur here. These are not NIH applications. Health is the use case. It comes secondary to the two fundamental science and engineering approaches. We're not applying technology that already exists that typically we see in, you know, some of our NIH applications. It's what is the new data linkages and methods to make that occur? What are the new advancements in computer science or engineering that are occurring? And then lastly, I just want to mention too, these are demonstration projects in scale. And so as you're thinking about these areas and your questions, it's also going to be important that you think about the scale for this program. We're not looking at randomized control trials, big sort of intervention and cohort studies. These are really demonstration projects that are advancing these two areas of science.
Thank you so much, Dana, for that clarification. We're gonna keep repeating this several times. But one of the requirements that you guys have are collaboration plans. All proposals must include a collaboration and management plan, and it cannot be more than 2 pages. The plan must describe description of the team and their roles. Here is where you talk about your clinician. Like Dana was saying, you're not just going to slap a person on, and you know their roles really will have to be defined here. What everybody is bringing to the table has to be laid out. This gets scrutinized and reviewed in panel. It must include a plan for integration and ways to support interdisciplinary collaboration. This is an interdisciplinary program. These will be interdisciplinary proposals. We want to see how each aspect of the project is being incorporated into the bigger picture and how that team science is happening, how that interdisciplinary collaboration is happening. And you need to have a team member's expertise for the project. So as Dana referred to, the clinical aspect, the technical aspects, you need to really balance the team and design your team based on essentially the needs of the proposed work. Tom, would you like to?
Yeah. So thanks, Goli. So all the proposals have to include a data management plan. The data management plan is up to 2 pages. And the data management plan has to describe how the proposal is going to conform to the NSF policy on dissemination and sharing of research results. So it'll cover things like the types of data you're going to collect, how you expect to share it, and so forth. These policies are fully described in the links that are provided here. One of those is in the grant proposal guide, the PAPG. If you're one of the proposals that gets selected for NIH funding, you're going to be required to comply with the NIH data management sharing policy. And I'm going to turn it over to Dana to discuss that.
So I think my biggest piece of advice here is, number one, you're to follow everything above this in the links first, because reminder that you're submitting to NSF. This is just an FYI, as I know investigators are really interested in making sure that they're complying with the new NIH data management sharing policy. If your application is selected to move over to NIH, we will, in our instructions, include information about how to make sure that your application is updated to comply with this policy. The good news is that between NSF and NIH, most of the policy overlaps between the two agencies. There are only a couple things that are in the NIH data management and sharing policy that are not in the NSF policy for data management. So move forward, put together your application as you would for NSF, but keep in mind that if you move on to NIH, you'll be receiving information from us about how to update your data management and sharing plan to comply with that policy.
Thanks, Dana. So The other thing is all the proposals have to include an evaluation component. And so the evaluation can target multiple areas, the technical functioning, the validity and reliability, the usability, the impact on biomedical and health outcomes. The evaluation should not be, and Dana said this earlier, I'm going to say it again, you should not include a randomized clinical trial. We're talking about things that are at a much earlier stage. A randomized clinical trial is not appropriate for the evaluation. It really needs to focus on you've made this advance in science or engineering. How do you evaluate that advance? How do you demonstrate success for the fundamental research contribution that you're making? So next slide, Goli.
Thank you, Tom and Dana. So we are just going to end things with a few final comments. Firstly, we want to highlight what proposals are not appropriate for this solicitation. We've kind of alluded to a lot of this already, and we're going to emphasize this again. The focus proposals that focus only on advancing biological, biomedical, or public health research without a new fundamental science or engineering aspect, the disciplines that we were just talking about, without having their major thrust, the major contribution being those NSF science areas, are not fit for the solicitation. Applications that propose basically applying existing fundamental science to the biomedical domain, like making an app for addressing some health disparity, like that is not going to be something that is going to be reviewed well here. It's not a good fit. If you are using EHR data, if you're using that for a health purpose, but the actual, what you're doing with the data aspect of it is not innovative. The computer science aspect of it is not innovative. That is not going to be a good fit. The focus on a topic has to fit the mission of the agency. So if your proposal is the primary focus of it is advancing health, it is a health proposal, or it's a biology or biomedical proposal, it should directly go to NIH. I want to give Dana and Tom a chance if they have any other creative project ideas or examples that'll help clarify this point, because we really want to make sure that this is clear for everybody.
Thanks, Goli. I think just to reiterate what you said, retooling an existing method or approach for a health use case is not going to suffice for this initiative. It is not a good fit. It would be a really good fit perhaps for NIH, but that is not something that would do well here. For example, taking something like ChatGPT and applying it to detect or to help with suicidal ideation or self-harm, that is not a good use. What are you advancing in ChatGPT? What are you advancing in the larger area of generative AI and large language models? Those are the questions that are being asked. And just to sort of hammer it in, health is a use case here. It takes a back seat to those core NSF questions of intellectual merit, broader impacts, et cetera, and how are you advancing the fundamental science areas?
And I really don't have anything to add. You guys have said it very well. I'll just say it again. Like, you have to make a fundamental contribution to science or engineering. You have to be able to state the intellectual merit and the broader impacts. It's not going to be a set of specific aims like it is with the NIH proposal. It's going to be the intellectual merit and the broader impacts. And that's what will carry your proposal.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. So if you guys didn't get it, I'm not going to repeat it a third time. So for you, if you want examples of what is appropriate and what has been successful, at least in the sense of balancing these disciplines, please use the resources available online. You can use our website, click on Search Awards. And then when you go into Search Awards, you can type in SCH and then see, click on any of the grants to see sort of what are the kind of work that's been funded. Some of the research focus areas have changed throughout the years, but you can at least see the sort of balance of disciplines that are important here.
And at NIH, we have Reporter. And similar to what Goli just put up for the NSF site, if you type in under the advanced project search the text for SCH in the project title, you will be able to pull up what has been funded on the NIH side under this initiative. And what you will see, as I mentioned earlier, these applications don't undergo a second review. And so when you click into any of these grants, actually, because they've been awarded, what you will see is that they're still very much so written in the NSF style and language. It's just been updated into the different bucket areas for NIH. So I highly recommend looking at that as well.
Thank you. So if you want feedback on your proposals, we've talked a lot about what is not a good fit. We've tried to talk a lot about what is a good fit. But if you need to get feedback, please send us a one-page summary of your proposal to schcorrespondence@nsf.gov. If you go to our program page or our solicitation page, you'll see that email listed also as a way to reach us. Please don't send us a NIH-specific AIMS page. The one-page summary, the guidelines are in PAPG listed in the link below. It needs to have a description of your project. As Tom said, the intellectual merit and the broader impacts, those need to be highlighted. We really are trying to find if it's a good fit based on where the advancement is. So these have to be highlighted and articulated well. The only thing I want to mention, well, the only caveat is we do have a high volume of requests, both at NSF, where Tom and I are, and some inquiries that go to NIH, although we encourage you to please send them here to us, because sometimes if you send them to NIH, they will send them to us anyway, so just send them here. There is a bit of a wait time for the turnaround time as we're getting through these one pagers. So if you want timely feedback on your request, please send it far enough in advance so that given the sort of the timeline that we're looking at for getting responses to you guys, that our response will actually still be helpful to you in writing your proposal. Please don't wait till last minute. That's basically our advice. Ask for help and ask early if you can. How does one apply? You go to our publication solicitation page. For NIH Institute specific interests, you can follow the announcement here. You can incorporate the NIH specific interests into the proposals, but it needs to be written in the NSF format and include transformative science aspects again and again and again. So written in NSF format, it's coming into NSF. It needs to, the main focus needs to be that transformative NSF science aspect. You can refer to the PAPG, and again, you can reach us at our email alias for any additional questions.
So, Goli, I'm just going to say, I'd recommend for everyone to submit their one pager early. If you don't hear back from that email address, re-ping. And for those of you who are more interested of who I talk to at NIH, my recommendation is to actually email that inbox first with the information that Goli put on the screen before. We work very closely with our NSF colleagues. Because these applications are submitted to NSF, it is most important that what you are proposing meets the format and the needs of the NSF application. To get information from there about the health context and use case, Goli, Tom, and others at NSF will then reach out to us at NIH to see if we need to have a separate one-on-one meeting ahead of time. Do not reach out to your NIH program officer first. As Goli mentioned, most of the time we will still send you back to this NSF correspondence email, which ultimately will make it longer in the queue for you. So just go there first, and then we'll loop around on the NIH side after you get that initial round of feedback.
Thank you. Okay, so consider joining our listserv. We send out information and updates on the program and opportunities that come up in the community. through this listserv. So just email us here and here are the instructions on how to join. We also have a smart health reviewer listserv that if you're interested in serving on NSF review panels for smart health, let us know. And we're always looking for your expertise to help us make, you know, enrich the program and make the review process better. And we can add you to that listserv as well. One last note, and Dana, if you want to close us off with this one, is the relay between basic and applied science that we are looking at.
Yeah, so this gets back to everything we've talked about before. These program or this program is funding really fundamental science, and it's a handoff between that basic and applied. This means that not only do your questions need to sort of address that with health as a use case, but you also need to have the right team that you're moving forward as part of this application.
Yep. Thank you so much. Again, send your questions and comments to our alias. And we are now going to move to the Q&A section. We see that there's 80, 90 questions that have already been posted. First off, I want to say that I'm sure a lot of them are asking about the recording from today. So I'm just going to repeat that again. This webinar was being recorded. It will be posted on our program page very shortly. We are also going to make the slides available for those who want it, including captioning for the slides and for the webinar. All right, so let's move on to Q&A. Any of my colleagues want to start by answering any questions while we kind of look through them?
So I can start with a few. I'll take the first couple, and then we can sort of triage from there. So one is, can a proposal have a PD or PI and another PI, as is the case with NIH? Yes, actually what we see with these applications is that traditionally there are about three MPIs, so multiple PIs on an actual application. It varies. But again, as we've mentioned before about the team, you need to be able to articulate how each of those individuals are going to contribute to the actual application and the project itself, and it needs to make sense. So if you don't need to have a multi-PI team, then you probably shouldn't include that in your application. The second question is, will the deadline extend if the government shuts down? We cannot speak to that at this moment. Right now we are open and we have no information about what that will look like. What you can expect and what I would encourage is to be looking at the NSF site, number one, for updates. Number two is joining the listserv community, as Goli put up on the last one of those last slides, that will be sending out information. So right now, the due date is November 9th. If anything were to change, you would either hear that through the listserv or on the NSF website.
About the Cognizant POs of who will receive the proposal, it's all going to come into the SCH solicitation ID. Like, it's going to come into one of us, me, I think, and then it's going to be moved to other program NSF program officers that are going to be handling the paneling for that particular topic and proposal. Dana, is there anybody in the AI system for brain cancer research that this would go to? Where should people
You can email me. I'm the NCI representative for this initiative. I can put you in contact with other program staff. If it's specifically about an AI system for brain cancer research applying through this program, I'm going to tell you to reach out to the SCH email first with the one pager. But if it is something else that would be broader than this initiative and applying through another program, then feel free to reach out to me.
As far as the clinical expertise, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but they can be covered by an international collaborator or consultant, but there are restrictions on how that funding will work. Rule of thumb is, I think, 20%, was it?
Yeah, I don't think there's a published number, but the rule of thumb I've been told is 20%. And Dana, maybe for something that's selected on the NIH side, is there hard and fast rule for, is there a limit on international collaborators on the NIH side?
There is not. I would say though, there are some budgetary and other things that, that apply, but I would say if you have specific questions about that to reach out, because I think it really depends on each individual institution and the intricacies there. Plus the fact that there's such a smaller proportion of these that are funded by NIH, I don't know that that would be the focus. I would really focus on what NSF policies are.
Okay. And Goli, can I jump back to one of your earlier questions? Sorry, yeah. I was trying to find the mute button and I couldn't. Somebody was asking like which PO it goes to and things like that. I'm going to give an answer that doesn't sound like it's an answer to that question, which is it depends a lot on your summary, like a well-written summary. Sorry, I'm a new IPA. I've been here since January. One of the things I didn't realize was how important all the ways the summaries get used once your proposal comes in. So a well-written summary will make sure that your proposal ends up with a similar set of proposals to be paneled with. So.
Yes, because that happens, that transfer happens within the working group. So the better your summary is, the better informed that paneling is going to be. So yes, yes, I second, third, fourth that. Is there an NIH salary cap, Dana?
There is, and they will apply if your application is selected for funding by NIH. So I'm not going to speak more on that because it really depends on whether or not you're funded by NIH. But if you are, those caps will apply. The next question is about, is the budget the same for NIH as NSF? And it is, and you will have to maintain the $1.2 million in total costs across the length of your project, which if you are selected for funding on the NIH side is usually a point in which you have to have some conversations with your program officer given the way the budget structuring is. But most applications and applicants that come over, they're able to make those adjustments just fine. The next one is about the co-PI and whether or not they're an early stage investigator under the NIH definition, which is within 10 years of terminal degree and not having a significant grant award like an R01, and whether or not an award for Smart Health would take away the co-PI's early stage investigator status. If you are funded through Smart Health and your application is funded by NSF, the co-PI's ESI status would not be impacted because you would not have received a substantial NIH award. If, however, you are funded and it is funded by one of the NIH institutes or centers and comes over, that co-PI would lose their early stage investigator status because these are awarded at NIH as R01s.
I can take next one. So how are key health issues defined? So there is a notice for NIH for this SCH program. Over there, different IC have their key research areas defined. So you may take a close look over there and to see what are the key research topics or research interests, you know, that are spelled out for each NIH IC. Thank you.
There's a question about the review process where you, they ask if NSF and NIH are doing joint reviews. So the actual review is done by PIs and experts in the field. When we say it's done by NIH and NSF, the PDs and the SROs are going to be managing the panel, but the reviews are going to be written by experts in the field.
And for the question, how much preliminary data analysis is expected? So the key point is that, you know, the preliminary data results are provided to help the review panel to properly assess the likelihood or feasibility of your project, also to evaluate your capability to carry out the proposed research. Just keep that in mind and use your own judgment to see how much data you should include.
Yeah, Yanli, let me add to that. So you need to provide evidence that your proposal is going to be, that your plan of research is going to be successful. Preliminary data is one form of that evidence, but it's not the only form. So you don't have to have preliminary data. There could be other ways to show the evidence that that what you're proposing to do will be successful.
There's a question about how it's determined if a grant gets funded by NSF or NIH. And if it can be by both or not, and do applicants get to choose? So it either gets funded by NIH or NSF, and there's nothing that the applicant can do to choose. Dana, do you want to talk about how the NIH process works? As we explained, we pass along the scoring and the reviews, and we release them to the PIs and then to NIH, and they go from there. But if there's any information you want to add.
Yeah, so there's no selection sort of or rights that the applicants have to determine which agency they go to. By submitting, you sort of understand that you could end up being funded by NSF, funding by NIH, or not funded at all. Those are really your three options. I will say that what we see with these scores and panel is that what the review criteria are for NIH and how those applications score do not align all the time with what the score is from an NSF perspective. And so when we go through the selection process, there isn't much fighting between NSF and NIH about the proposals that each agency wants to fund. And there is a question about the reviewers in these panels. And the reviewers in the panel are those who have more of an NSF lens. There are some with some health expertise. But we increasingly, as this program has evolved since it is going into its 10th year, we now have a pretty big community of individuals who now have gone through this program and have worked on both the traditional NSF side and the NIH side. And so we also have a lot of those reviewers that are in the panel as well, who are able to bridge both of these areas and speak to both sort of the health application as well as the broader impacts and intellectual merit.
As far as how often, I see a few questions about how, if this is a year, this is a yearly program, and the solicitation right now is active for the next 3 years. So we just published a new solicitation, so up to 2026.
And in terms of how many awards will be funded by the NSF and by NIH, that really depends on the availability of funds and the merit of the proposals that are received. And so that can vary each year. There's not a set amount or number that are funded.
Again, about the team, there's questions if there should be a medical doc, and if like the how your team is made up is going to influence whether you're going to be funded by NIH or NSF, and that's irrelevant as we... I think we mentioned before, who you include on your team is really determined by your project, and especially the clinical aspect of it and all that stuff. The makeup of your team is not going to be at all important in which who gets picked up by NIH or NSF.
There's a question about how many proposals are submitted, and that's not public information. I think that you can gather there's quite a number that are submitted each year based off of the number of directorates at NSF and the participation across NIH institute centers and offices.
And again, no clinical trials. That was one of the questions. Are support letters recommended from clinical collaborators? Yes, I think collaboration letters and support letters, essentially your collaboration plan needs to be solid and you need to have support from all the important people.
Yep. But I would add to that, you should look at the PAPG that has a description of what's allowed for a support letter. It can't be, this research is going to be great. I really look forward to seeing this research. It's got to be, there's an unfunded collaboration and that's been mentioned in the proposal. And the person is saying, yes, I will participate in the way that's described in the proposal.
So there's a question about, should PIs only target the NSF evaluation criteria in writing the proposal, or if a PI is writing a proposal that better targets an NIH institute, should the proposal target NIH evaluation criteria? You are submitting your application to NSF. Thus, you should be targeting the NSF criteria. The NIH criteria are not important. Again, you are submitting your application to NSF, and it is undergoing review at NSF with participation of an NIH SRO, and it will receive that score. But ultimately, the NSF criteria trumps NIH.
And I will add to that as well. What's going to happen is the reviewers will be asked, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the intellectual merit? What are the strengths and weaknesses of the broader impact, amongst other things? But those will be the two lead questions in their review that they'll write. So you really should address those in your proposal.
Again, the webinar will be available online. And as far as two PIs from the same institute being able to be on one application, I don't think we have anything against that.
No.
We want to see collaboration. We want to see varied, you know, all the disciplines that are important for your project to be involved, but there's no mandate on them being from different institutes. Can these be single PI proposals? Yeah. But can they actually, Tom? No, it is a collaboration.
Well, in theory, you could have a single PI if they were somehow another, an expert in the health area,
right,
in the two areas they were going to make the science and engineering advances in. But in practice, that's not very likely.
Right. So there's no limit or restrictions on who may serve as a PI or sort of limit the number of institutions. So
here's a question for the NSF team. What is a suggested proposed start date that they should put in their applications?
At least 6 months after the submission date. And a couple months beyond that would probably also be good.
Yeah, but that is also something that can be changed later.
Yeah.
So when we get closer to the awards, it's not like you're married to that date. But we do want to see, you know, it's relevant, but that can, if the award process gets delayed, the start date can get pushed back.
Yeah, but anything less than 6 months is unrealistic.
Yeah.
And same thing, if you move over to NIH, we can modify the start date as well.
Yep.
Another question is about the two fundamental areas within a potential bullet, such as computer science and math or robotics and NLP, is that allowed? I think the answer is yes.
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 Related, I was looking at it. I almost thought you were answering my question that I was looking at. It was like, can it one be AI and the other area be advancement in health? No, the two areas have to be NSF. So AI and math with the contribution to be made in health. So the research itself can't be in health.
So there's a question about the early stage investigator status and if that's considered during the review process, and would someone lose their ESI status? As I said before, if you're funded by NIH, you would lose your ESI status. In terms of the review process, it is not discussed during the review about ESI status. However, when applications are percentiled and scored, the program staff do look at their respective institute or center pay lines, and they would apply the ESI pay lines to those applications that would qualify under the ESI status.
More questions on timeline. Again, proposals due. We're looking at a minimum 6 months to a year. It may even go up as late as December if it goes to NIH for funding.
So someone asked about the discussion on clinical trials, should there be or not be trials in a proposal? And I think the clarification is we're talking about no randomized controlled trials or RCTs, large scale sort of interventions that you would typically see in large NIH R01s. We have seen though, based off of the NIH definition of a clinical trial, when you come over to NIH, your project proposal may have components that are classified under the NIH definition of a clinical trial. We are not excluding those. We are just saying that these large scale studies are not going to be one a good fit, nor would you be able to do them with the budget of this program. And so we strongly discourage any of that coming through. Again, these are supposed to be demonstration projects.
And so you probably need some preliminary data. Like there was a question about that, but it would help.
So this is
a big deal.
Yeah, this will be a R01 grant for NIH. So for R01, preliminary data is required.
So how is it determined which projects move to NIH? It depends on the NIH score and percentile and alignment with NIH IC specific interests, which are outlined in the notice that we've provided in the presentation. But again, just reiterating that there is no involvement from the PIs in sort of pushing either way where their application ends up.
And more questions about, yes, some of them will be funded by NSF, some of them will be funded by NIH. And who will decide that is the NIH institutes and centers and the NSF side based on the programmatic considerations and stuff after the reviews are done.
So changes compared to the solicitation from previous years. Some of the thematic areas have changed with this solicitation. The policies and procedures have updated to be in accordance with anything that has changed in the past several years at NSF and highlighting today as well. For example, the new NIH data management and sharing plan. But the budget, for example, has not changed, nor has the overall sort of theme of the overall solicitation and what we're trying to achieve with this initiative, and the requirements of having a health, advancing health within two, but making two sort of fundamental science and technology contributions. So overall, the goals of the program have remained the same, but some of the specifics in the thematic areas are really what have changed.
Lots of single PI versus multiple PIs. I think we already addressed that. Realistically, it would have to be multiple PIs unless one PI really has all those expertise.
I will say there is a question about success of one versus multiple. And I think we've seen both come through and have a lot of multiple PIs. That's a big portion of what comes in through Smart Health, but we do have a lot of single PIs. And in those single PI applications though, they do have collaborators in other areas that are contributing a significant amount of time, and that is outlined in their collaboration plan as well. So it depends on how you want to structure your application, but both mm-hmm. have been funded in the program.
Thank you for that clarification. Because when I was thinking, because yeah, we're constantly thinking it could, yeah, it has to be, it depends on the collaboration plan. Someone's asking how important is it to explain how the research specifically can translate into health impact. If your health problem is not clear, it'll reduce the impact rating of the panel of your proposal. So if you don't have a clear health problem in mind, that usually works against you. There needs to be a clear health problem that this is applying to. But again, it has to be in the main science disciplines that we listed, just with the impact being in health. And international collaborators are allowed, but there's limitations on funding. NSF doesn't usually like to give direct funds to international partners, and the rule of thumb is about 20%. So there's more to look into for that as far as international partners go. Again, the two fundamental areas: one cannot be biomedical science. It has to be the four disciplines that we talked about: computer science, engineering, social behavioral sciences, and math or MPS.
So there's a question about the academic salary for PIs and co-PIs, and that's not normally allowed from NSF, but is permitted for NIH. Goli or Tom, do you want to speak to the NSF side of salaries, and then I can speak to the NIH?
I was a little bit more experienced in the salary side.
Yeah, no. Normally, it's limited to total support of up to 2 months across all your NSF funding. So if you were selected for funding, then we would check to make sure that, given all your other active awards, that you didn't go above 2 months.
And then on the NIH side, the normal sort of salary limitations apply. And usually what happens is actually those, that allotment is a bit different. And so there is modification that occurs, not in the total cost of the budget, but the actual dollar amounts, especially for salaries that occur when you make that transition over to NIH. If we're interested in reviewing, how do we get on the listserv? That is included in the slides that Goli put up earlier. You can probably also email the SCH email address as well and let them know that you're interested. I would also suggest putting in there information about your expertise and maybe even attaching a CV.
That would always help, yes. And we could ask you for other panels as well that are smart health or health informatics or something like that related. So. Thank you for those who are interested and want to volunteer. That really makes a big difference for us. The limit for PIs and co-PIs on a proposal is 2. I can copy paste the area in the solicitation, but please go look at the eligibility information section of the solicitation for the types of organizations and number of PIs.
So there's another budgetary question about the indirect cost rate. I don't know, Tom, if you want to comment on that from an NSF perspective.
Yeah, I saw that off the top of my head. I don't know of any limits on the indirect rate. I think that's negotiated between the federal government and the institution. And I don't think there's a limit on the number from an institution either. There's just the limit on the PIs. On the number per PI that Goli just mentioned.
What type of feedback may individuals get on their one pager? Will we say something like, don't send this at all, or you didn't make something clear? It's important since the same work idea may be presented very differently in a one pager.
Yeah, so I've been handling most of these. I can't speak for Goalie. I have yet to send a don't send this at all. I have sent a few. I don't know what your intellectual merit and your broader impacts are. Like, you have to say what your contributions are to two areas of science or engineering. I tend to ask a lot of questions.
Honestly, some of the only times that we say, don't send this to us, send this to NIH, is when it's very clearly a health oriented proposal, where there really is very little computer science or any of the other science fields that we talk about. We say, unless there's that computer science advancement, like, it's not going to be a good fit. We try to be as gentle as possible about it, but the only outright no's I've had are that, or if it's like an institute that is not qualified to apply or something like that. So I would really recommend, please read the solicitation before putting in the time to write a one pager, like if you are in an institute that doesn't qualify for applying or things like that.
I've sent a number of these on over the years, and I will say I have told many that I am not able to deduce what their intellectual merit and broader impacts are, and that either the format itself is written, like its specific aims and whatnot, and that's not going to be received at NSF well, or that actually, even if you can deduce from that one pager in the incorrect form, that irrespective of that, it's still not going to be applicable to smart health. So I have seen a bunch of those over the years. And I think, as Goalie and Tom said, we try to be gentle about it through what we say, but you really need to have intellectual merit and broader impacts.
Yeah, but we also don't want to waste your time, right? We want you to be successful, so.
There's a question here about subcontracting to industry partners. So outsourcing to a virtual reality environment for therapeutic intervention purposes, for example. So before I hand it to you, Goalie and Tom, to fully answer this, I'll say this is, as this reads, for example, this is something where I immediately look at this and go, what is novel and what's smart health about this this potential project? If you already have a virtual reality environment, and in this case, if you were going to be doing a therapeutic intervention, that is most likely out of scope for this. Again, these are demonstration projects. So what's novel about the virtual reality, and then the size and scale of what it is you would be proposing here. But to the actual question about subcontracting to industry, Goalie and Tom.
Dana, you gave a very good answer, because the answer is yes, you could have a subcontract to industry, but the question is going to be, what's the contribution there? And it probably shouldn't be too big a fraction of the budget. Let's say it's not VR for a second. Let's say there you were doing one of the novel cyber-physical system substrates that I mentioned earlier, and you need some manufacturing to occur. You don't have the capabilities to do that. That would be a reason to do it. So it's allowed. You're just going to have to justify it. It's going to have to make sense in the context of your research plan.
Right. And I think some of the materials, like you mentioned something, Tom, about I think that's more on the university side of sort of what are eligible costs and stuff like that for some of the material. So I'm not going to get into that, but yep. Short answer is yes. And I think you guys covered everything there. I wanted to touch base on actually a question that I just saw and I think is important, which is about resubmission. So the question is whether resubmission of proposals, if there's any difference between a new submission and a resubmission, and if they have to respond to reviewer comments from the previous round. So this is where we kind of have a stark difference between NIH and NSF in how we handle reviews. All the proposals that come into this program are reviewed by NSF. Now, we have records of your previous submissions. And once the reviews are done, the program directors bring those into consideration. And for the sort of next level assessment, we consider that resubmission factor. And sometimes in some proposals, people may refer to sort of like, I did this before, I'm doing this, from this I found this, and I'm doing this now, and sort of setting up the project. But it is not that the same way that NIH proposals resubmission works, where the review panel that you have, you're going to get at NSF, is not going to see your previous proposal. They're not going to see the comments from the reviewers. It's not going to be like, oh, they were told this. It is not going to be the same people. It's not going to go back to the same reviewers. So it 99.9% of the time, we probably won't even have any reviewers in common. So it's going to be a whole new panel and a whole new review. And although addressing some of those reviewer comments is going to help you, it's not going to necessarily be seen by the reviewers. Now, when we do our reviews, and that's what we ask of our reviewers, and hopefully if when you are a reviewer, you will be asked this as well, is please make it as constructive and as productive as possible. So we want you to get useful reviews. We want you to get and summaries. We want you to get, you know, help in if you want to resubmit, but it's not going to have that continuity in the NSF side. I don't know if you want to add anything, Tom or Dana, about anything like that. Okay. Yeah, this is an NSF proposal, NSF program, and those are the review processes that are going to guide, you know, all this whole decision process.
So I will say, Goli, there is one question that I think is really important. It's about STTR and SBIR and options for those who would be interested. Unfortunately, for this solicitation, individuals coming in through that mechanism are not allowed. So we're not allowing the small businesses, for example, to apply. If you are a small business, you can apply to the normal sort of SBIR, STTR funding call for either NSF or NIH. But in terms of whether or not the work funded by this mechanism can be commercialized, yes, and we have seen number of the applicant teams that have been funded through this make it all the way through not only commercializing, but having FDA approval and even being bought by commercial industry as well. So there are options outside of this, and we see that this is this initiative being a launching point for some of those investigative teams.
There's a question about IRB. And I wanted to see if I could get you guys' help on answering that one, because they're asking it that demonstrations are fine and the randomized clinical trials are not in scope, but does this imply that IRB studies are out of scope? And if not, how should we think about what might be acceptable and what it may not be?
Human subjects is allowed under Smart Health. We have a number of applicant teams and funded awards that have IRB sort of requirements with them, and you should be prepared to meet the regulatory sort of statutes for your IRBs with this.
Yes, I was going to say, yeah, we will need updated IRB approvals and stuff like that for those that include them. But Tom, do you want to expand on that at all?
And I was just going to say, like, the demonstrations can still require IRB approval because you're using human subjects, you're collecting mm-hmm. data from them. That's not necessarily the scale of, you know, randomized controlled trial that we have in mind. Like when we're talking about those types of trials in the solicitation, what we really mean is you've already got the device ready and you're just trying to prove its efficacy. What's appropriate is I've got this proposed device that I want to establish that it actually works and prove, you know, its feasibility. And so I need to recruit subjects for that, or I need to do some sort of experimentation on that. That would be subject to IRB, but it doesn't rise to the level of a randomized control trial.
right. We have about 5 more minutes left of the allotted time. So I wonder if anybody in our group, I want to give time to others. I don't know. I think Jim left, but Yan Li, if there's any other questions that you felt were important to bring up for everyone.
Sorry, Goalie, I'm trying to scan down through the questions really quickly and get the, and I think you are too, trying to get the low-hanging fruit.
So some of the questions, as I'm just skimming through them, are kind of project specific and, oh, I'm in this field, is this appropriate? I'm in that. For those pre-Sendless one pagers, please reach out to the email alias. I don't think a lot of them we can answer without knowing more, you know, having more context. Again, our email alias is sch-correspondence@nsf.gov. And I think we can put that in the chat for everyone.
Yeah, here also there is a few questions relating, I think, to one issue. So people were asking, about, if the application is not reviewed well by NSF, is there going to be like still a chance for NIH to pick it up? And then the another question, but for this, basically the same concern here. So may you clarify the funding process? So if the proposal will be sent to NIH and NSF jointly, does it require that the funded proposal must meet fundable score from both NIH and NSF? What if the proposal received a fundable score from only one of both? Is it considering to be funded? So someone would like to clarify.
So it doesn't need to have a fundable score from both agencies. And to be honest, when NIH looks at the scores, we are not looking at what the scores are at NSF. And I highly doubt, but I won't speak for my NSF colleagues, that the same happens in reverse. So you don't need to have a fundable score from both, and both agencies will end up, I believe, at least on the NIH side, we are only looking at the NIH scores. We're not looking at NSF.
Right. And what I will say is, having sat in on a bunch of the panels, is there tends to be a good correlation between the NSF ratings and the NIH scores, but it's not a perfect correlation. And the easiest thing to point out is the broader impacts matter heavily to the NSF rating, but less heavily, don't factor into the NIH rating. And so that you can end up with differences in scores that way. So something that's chosen for funding for the NIH might not have been the top of the heap for the NSF and vice versa. So. And so Dave, if I said something there that put words in the NIH's mouth, feel free to stop.
No, you're fine. I do see a question here, though, that I think is important, which is about limitations to the health use case. And do they have to be limited to one, or can they have multiple use cases? And I've seen both. And I think that it depends on what it is you're proposing and making sure you articulate that in your proposal. So for example, I've seen applications come through in which they are developing a device for a specific health context. It wouldn't make sense to boil the ocean and include others. Whereas potentially on the flip side of that, there are novel sort of pipelines, data linkage approaches, analytical methods that are being developed, and they're using different health contexts and use cases through different data sets and whatnot to demonstrate that approach. But usually, even if there are multiple, there all are in some way, and this is not an all or nothing, I've seen both, but for the most part, they're somewhat interrelated, like the cardiovascular aspects of, myocardial infarction to cardiovascular related issues in Alzheimer's disease or cardiotoxicity in cancer. So there's an underlying theme, even though multiple data sets are being used.
Some of them, sometimes the method can be applied to several health problems. Like for example, in some of the imaging projects, like you can develop something for imaging the brain for so-and-so problem, but then it gets expanded. Like it could be the primary focus could be vision, but then it could be expanded to hearing or other array of health issues. That sort of expansion and broader impact of the project is something that we value. So if the health area, if the method that you're proposing, if the advancement that you're making can contribute, you will have to have one primary health goal. That's usually, those usually do better. But then if it expands and it can be applied to other areas, by all means, like let us know and say that this is expandable and this is advancing the field. Which will be applied to all these health areas in that sense. So if the proposal is selected by NIH, do they have to rewrite the proposal for NIH guidelines? There's going to be a little bit of that, but can you explain that, Dana or Jan?
So there's some modifications that have to happen, but generally the content of what's being proposed is not really modified. It's just filling into the new areas and then modifying the budgets. I wouldn't worry as much about that. You will get very detailed instructions from NIH and NSF if your application moves forward that'll help you move through that process.
Okay. And sometimes people ask about the page limit. So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Dana. So here we try to be generous. So NIH requires 5 pages as the limit. However, if, you know, for this proposal, if it's 15 pages, we will take it without asking PI to cut down the length of the proposal or research strategy.
We are past 4:30 now, so in case I don't want people who had questions that, you know, I don't want people to miss the answers to the questions, so I kind of want to stop things right now and encourage everyone, if your question wasn't answered, if you have additional questions, reach us at our email at NINSF. And I wanted to take this time to thank everybody. Thank my colleagues, Tom and Dana, Yan Li, David, Rhea, and Jim, and our NSF coordinators that are helping us run this. So thank you all so much. Good luck with the proposals, everyone. Happy writing. And we will hear from you in our email, in our inbox.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye now.
Thank you, everyone.